Welcome, everyone. This is the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, June 15, 2013. My name is Marcia Mary Baker. Our topic for today is the North American Water and Power Alliance, called NAWPA. NAWPA is not optional. Starvation is stalking Mexico and the Americas. Will you be next? So with this grim agenda for discussion, I'm very glad that we have with us here live in the studio, Cynthia Rush. Welcome, Cynthia.
Hi, Marcia.
And Cynthia's been on here, I'm glad to say, many times in recent years. I remind everyone, she is from the Ibero-American staff of Executive Intelligence Review. And in particular, she has an overview on developments in Mexico, Central and South America, regarding food and water, very basics, but also the related political developments. But what we have confronting us is a growing horror of malnutrition, hunger, and death toll in the Americas. At the same time, we appreciate that some of the most beautiful agroclimatic potentials are here in South America, in the Caribbean, and here in North America. And we have a history of many particular projects or improvements in these potentials, realizations of them. But right now, we have an emergency situation because there have been policies, deliberate policies, to deplete and ruin land, water, and food-producing regions. And this is for reasons, as I say, it's deliberate for reasons of intent, emanating out of the financial, commodity, and power networks that are best called the Empire, the British Empire, the Anglo-Dutch Empire. There are names of the famous commodity companies, everything from Royal Dutch Shell to Unilever involved. Names of rotten operatives, you know some of them, you can imagine, like George Soros, but I also include the philanthropo-fascist Bill Gates. Many names like this, but this network that's operating on behalf of the royalist imperial interest to literally force depopulation in the world. This is best seen in the Queen, who's just in the last 48 hours, if you're listening this weekend of June 15th, you'll see a lot of celebrations with her presiding in London. And just keep your, excuse me, barf bag. I watched it this morning. I mean, this kind of holdover from continuities of empires in the past, whether it's the Roman Empire or the Venetians who ruled the Mediterranean and decided who would eat and who wouldn't eat during the 1300s. This kind of thing is what we're facing here. And I will get into that in specific with many, with reports by Cynthia on different aspects of this picture. But first, let me just say about the situation we face in general, especially to those regular listeners here in the United States. We exert everything you can now for what needs to be done, because it's do or die, against these networks. And that would be to the edge on the knife to strike the lethal blow against the continuation of this kind of thing is forcing the Glass-Steagall, forcing the reinstatement through as United States policy here of the Glass-Steagall Act. As you know, it was put in 1933. That's not our specific topic today, but this is essential to end this destruction, financial bailout, financial bail-in, flim-flam that's supporting these looting networks, and to create the conditions for us to build up the means of existence and to have a future. And you know the bills are in Congress, House of Representatives 129. In the Senate, it's Senate Bill S-985. In the last 76 hours here, there's the 22nd or 23rd state has memorialized their Congress to act on it, and that's New Jersey. In Trenton, the legislature there has introduced a memorial, And also in New York State, which had done this the week before, and that's the Big Apple, whatever we think of the other 49 states, this is New York where Wall Street is located. They have an active bill in their state legislature in Albany, and one of the sponsors has issued a press release in the last couple days of why this should be done. So I'm describing these two recent instances because they're instances of motion. And you know that this is part of flanking the situation of intransigence and Wall Street pressure on Capitol Hill in Congress, besides a certain heavy quotient of stupidity and cowardice. But we can force the issue. Now, Congress this weekend is back wherever they choose to be over the weekend, but they're resuming Monday and Tuesday, that would be the 17th and 18th, their hearings. And I'm sure people appreciate some aspect of the fact that we have Obama himself on the ropes politically with all of the revelations and expose over the National Security Agency monitoring millions of phone call and other kinds of communications, many other things. But Obama himself is a pawn for the networks I'm describing, for Queenie, and this modern day neo-British Empire imperialism. So we need to take it from the top and not figure that any one scandal is what we have to motivate to our friends, neighbors, and enemies they should act on. We've got to bring this whole thing down, and that's why I stress get the Glass-Steagall as the leading edge on this and go for getting him out of office. The continuation is just a continuation of destruction, of having him there. One thing I want to say, and then I'll turn right away to Cynthia to begin with a status report on the scale and degree of hunger in our own hemisphere. But Mr. LaRouche has thrown into this mobilization we're doing a new paper that you'll find posted on LaRouchePub.com, where you're listening to this, or LaRouchePAC.com, the Political Action Committee. It'll be there within 24 hours. It's finished, and he's addressing not what to think or what to promote, but how to think, which is something relevant to every one of us and has gone out of style. Let me just be popularistic about it. So please watch for that in the next 24 hours. And the other thing is, I want to stress in the midst of everything, a special event in the series of Schiller Institute international conferences that we need a new paradigm for how to think and for how to fight for policies and how to be moralized, what to understand is science and culture. Now that's going to be in San Francisco, June 29. That's a Saturday. It's all day the Saturday of June 29 in downtown San Francisco. And email me or this radio show or Marcia Baker at LaRouchePub.com, or get in touch with anyone that you know is associated with the LaRouche Political Action Committee or Schiller Institute, EIR online, if you want particulars to where it is. But I urge you now, those of you who can drive, swim, or otherwise get there or take a red eye, you still have time to order, to book such a flight, and plan to attend. The conference itself is on really the new American revolution we need to have. And it will be discussed just what Cynthia is going through about the fact of the North American Water and Power Alliance in North America and related, there are complete sister projects in Mexico and in South America. And in fact, in the Pacific, we need an orientation for peace through development and away from what otherwise is the intent of these networks that would perpetrate destruction and depopulation. They plan to have war if they don't get their own way. And that's finally what's shaping up in the last 4 or 5 days. The announcements from Washington, that the assertion that the grounds are now there for Syria, the United States is going to be sending arms to Syria, The United States may initiate a no-fly zone over a portion of Syria, perhaps out of Jordan. All these assertions are coming out, and in the last 48 hours from Moscow, the line has been drawn. These start to conduct a no-fly zone under any name, NATO, UN, United States, Britain, France, unilaterally. This is considered an act of war. So this just provides the urgency for us acting to end this madness. And with that, let me ask Cynthia if you'll just, I mentioned if you just want to begin with giving us the dimensions of literally when it comes to the means of existence of food. We are in a crisis situation in Central America, parts of South America and the Caribbean. And if you could begin there, thanks.
Yeah, well, actually, what I think I would like to do first is just give kind of an overview of the, starting with Mexico, because of course, it's not only on our border, but the area of that nation that is most affected by drought, northern Mexico, north central, parts of the central region are part of what we call the Great American Desert, which of course, the United States areas most affected by the drought in the southwestern United States, western Canada. So there's a real premium on, as you said, the kind of dramatic infrastructure, North American Water and Power Alliance, and some specific infrastructure projects in Mexico that are needed yesterday to address the magnitude of this crisis. If you look at Mexico, right now you have a situation where out of 32 states, 21 of them are affected by severe drought. And we're talking about approximately 48 million people living in that region out of Mexico's total population of 115 million. You have had a dramatic decline in agricultural production, obviously, a dramatic kill off of the cattle, national cattle herd, either dying or being sold off because farmers can't afford to feed them. And the United States has actually purchased large quantities of Mexican cattle. Some of our Mexican political activists and representatives of the farming and peasant sector have warned that Mexico faces a national security threat because one of them predicted a 20% drop in agricultural production this year, but this comes on top of a figure for last year in which agricultural production had already dropped 40%. Mexico, we have now in a situation compared to 30 years ago, where it has to import 40 to 50% of the food that it needs for national consumption. And
yeah, let me think. I think in the 1960s, they were exporters of grain anyway,
yes.
Right? Of
yes.
Net exporters
corn.
For South America and the island nations in the Caribbean.
Absolutely. Corn and wheat. I've seen estimates of as high as 60% of the national territory that is affected by the drought, and you have a process of also desertification, that is the, you know, just the land is being completely dried out where it's, you know, not possible to even, there's no vegetation, so you can't grow anything. One figure I saw recently also from Northern Mexican farmers saying that 5 million hectares, which translates into about 12 and a little over 12 million acres, have been taken out of food production in northern Mexico.
Largely, that'd be like taking the entire state of Iowa's production out of the United States.
For grain. So now Mexico is importing grains. We have the situation where last year Mexico had to import 50% of the wheat that it uses for national food consumption, 25% of its corn, 70% of rice, because these no longer are able to be produced in the country. And I think it's worth mentioning here that if you go back to the mid-1970s, Mexico was about 80% food self-sufficient. And you had, up until the period of the José López Portillo presidency, which ended in 1982, you had in place a number of structures, agencies, state-run entities that were put in place decades earlier in order precisely to protect the producer, the farmer, and the citizen, to make sure that they would have access to cheap and nutritious food.
Yeah, I remember one, CONASUPO.
Yes, right.
And they, I think they would deal with, for example, orderly import of milk powder, which is a big, which had a special role in a lot of Mexican diet.
Yes, and I think also they handled marketing in terms of giving fair prices for producers. Under López Portillo, he created what was called the Mexican Food Program, which actually, this was in 1980, which set out some specific goals for increasing food production and bringing more land under cultivation. So that the idea was that by 1982, 1983, 85, Mexico could once again become completely food self-sufficient. Now, as we...
Can I ask you to, sorry to interrupt, but, and let's stress again that this, that's interesting, I didn't know about that. But, and he also had a nuclear power development program. It was integral to the idea that you'd have enough power that you could organize what you need to intervene to improve the soils or to reorganize water. And,
exactly.
And he had a certain number of power plants proposed, right?
Yes, I think eight was the figure. Of course, that has now pretty much been abandoned.
There's just one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And of course, people may remember or not that Lyndon LaRouche, of course, was a key ally of López Portillo. Met with him personally a couple of times, and that was really emblematic of the kind of relationship that, as LaRouche constantly has reiterated, that kind of alliance among sovereign nation states, with people who are committed to the same policy outlook of mutual self-interest of their nations and promoting the development programs required. After 1982, and the successor to López Portillo was a neoliberal monetarist, and as were all subsequent presidents, that nationalist tradition was completely crushed. And all of the mechanisms that had been in place for the general welfare of the population were dismantled. The key point being the 1994 enactment of the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, which then saw the movement toward the complete destruction of Mexican agriculture because all protective tariffs were eliminated and the country was flooded with cheap U.S. food and Mexican corn, wheat, rice. Producers simply could not compete with that, as was the case throughout Central America. That's the way Haiti's rice production capacity was completely wiped out. Haiti had been also, I think, 80% self-sufficient in rice production up through the 1970s, 1980s, and then that was actually under Bill Clinton. American rice flooded Haiti, and today Haiti has to import 80% of its rice for national, local consumption. Half of its food has to be imported. So this is really the kind of insanity which, in the case of all of these nations, has resulted in unbelievable rates of death, malnutrition, starvation, especially among children, which, you know, if that's not addressed immediately, we will have no
vast depopulation. Yeah,
yeah, absolutely.
And to your time, to your chronology there, it was January 1995, then on a world scale came the World Trade Organization.
Right.
So the same, the process became very severe.
Mm-hmm. So we have recently, just last week, we put out an EIR package on Mexico. But, you know, again, looking toward the, what is the programmatic approach that is required immediately, and also the necessary defeat of this green fascism, environmentalism, which is unfortunately very prevalent in Mexico today, still, even though there's been a change in the government. And the new president, Peña Nieto, has, you know, stated some determination to have a change in policy, agricultural policy in particular, to provide more credit, to address the hunger, the drought, etc. But fundamentally, there is no significant change in the overall economic and political policy that has created this devastation in the first place.
Well, let me ask you, maybe this is where you want to draw out a minute, although we can also, I know you have a report on absolute lack of food in other places, including, of all things, Venezuela, as well as Central America. Let's come back. But when you mentioned green, there has this whole time, in addition to the borderless trade was imposed, which meant you got rid of, in addition to that was imposed this evil outlook saying that you shouldn't even intervene to reorganize and upgrade water to move it from where it's prevalent, which is in pretty much southern Mexico and off the slopes in the Sierra Madre.
Right.
And because that would be in violation of Mother Earth or something. And so you're saying that.
Yes, we had the case in the previous Calderon administration of this character we identified at the time as an agent of the Worldwide Fund for Nature of Prince Philip, the genocidal organization. This individual, Jorge Tamargo, was the head of the National Water Commission in Mexico, and he was completely committed to no development of water infrastructure, no moving of water anywhere. Manage your austerity, manage your scarcity, right? Have more efficient use of resources, etc. And from what I've seen so far, that outlook remains more or less in place. They're even considering now water rationing from the new head of the National Water Commission, who seems to be a fairly, you know, competent, decent person, but they're stuck in this outlook
that
of,
you can't do, that resources
are
fixed as opposed to something you develop. Okay.
Absolutely.
Well, I had interrupted you, but what you've been stressing that we have millions in effect in the Americas now currently without enough food.
Yes. And that is, well, I can mention parts of Central America where, and here it's important to mention, we were talking earlier, I noticed looking back today, pretty much 5 years ago to almost the month, April of 2008, Central America was an absolute dire food emergency. Agriculture and other government officials were meeting weekly to try to figure out, because there had been such a depletion of or destruction of their ability to produce food.
Yeah, it was called a world food shock at the time too,
right? Because as we know, there were food riots, in fact, in several countries in the world.
Right.
Egypt, I think, was one of them, Haiti, throughout Central America. And this really coincides with what happened in South America and in Central America at the time, where you had a huge push toward the production of biofuels, which of course we know here in the US, we're taking our 40% of our corn crop and putting it into ethanol production. You had a drive under the George W. Bush administration for ethanol production in Central and South America, which supposedly was going to be the basis for consolidating a new development revolution. Ethanol was going to be the basis for ending poverty and creating jobs. Well, that didn't happen. Bush did a whole junket himself personally to five or six countries in Central and South America, special targeting of Brazil to pull them into this. But what you saw was all of these Central American countries, which once had been, let's say 30 years ago, they were pretty much able to produce corn and wheat for their own domestic consumption, you know, maybe 80% or so. But you started to get the same phenomenon I mentioned in Mexico with NAFTA. You had similar agreements where they started flooding these countries with cheap corn, cheap rice. Others wiped out domestic producers and farmers. So they were forced to import corn, for example. That was in the mid, you know, 2005, 6, 7, 8.
You're talking about Guatemala.
Guatemala, Nicaragua, Honduras, mm-hmm. pretty much all of them. Mm-hmm. But at the point where you started getting this drive for biofuels and the demand for corn went up, you also saw a consequent rise in the price of corn. So these countries were starting to have to pay much more money for no longer cheap corn, which had a huge toll in terms of, you know, poor farmers, peasants who were subsistence farmers or, you know, were producing a little bit of food, mostly for their families and maybe selling some on the side to make some money. So you had people unable to produce, to afford corn. And then you also had a gigantic pressure from agribusiness, cartels, financial speculators and predators, George Soros's friends, private equity funds, the guys that are based in the Cayman Islands and Hong Kong and other such lovely locations, jumping into these places, demanding that biofuels be produced. And more land, what little, say, corn was being produced, was being gobbled up, in fact, by these larger operations.
Converted into neo-plantations for sugarcane.
Absolutely.
Ethanol. And absolutely. I guess you're saying palm was introduced for biodiesel.
African palm. Sugar also. Large sugarcane plantations. So a lot of farmers were being pressured to sell their land to these larger operations. Cargill is one of them. Archer Daniels Midland. Bunge. The big cartel. All of these guys are involved in this. So you had the price of commodities going up tremendously, you know, worldwide as a result of this kind of phenomenon, and people unable to afford to buy food. I can mention the case of Guatemala, which is really quite astounding, where I came across a researcher for a local nonprofit who just said the average Guatemalan is now hungrier because of biofuels development. You have this country, which is actually a decent sized country.
I think there are 15 million people or so. I mean, there are only 35 million people in Canada.
Yeah.
That's a different story, but related.
Who have, you know, good land and incredibly impoverished population, but this country has the highest rate of child malnutrition in the Western Hemisphere. 50% of all children under the age of 5, which is higher even than Haiti. And I think when you get into the really poor indigenous populations, talking about 80% of children under 5. So you know, you could go country by country. You combine that situation with the drought. Also, there's been a very severe drought in parts of Central America, in Guatemala. Panama just had a devastating drought. Honduras, 70% of land under cultivation was affected by drought over the past 9 or 10 months. Affecting food production, cattle production. So this is just an absolute devastation. And there's absolutely nothing that can address this other than what Lyndon LaRouche has put forward and his associates in terms of the kind of infrastructure, urgent infrastructure. And if we're going to wipe out Wall Street and these financial vultures who prey on populations in order to have their biofuel, gigantic biofuel profits, then we have to have Glass-Steagall. It's the only possible solution.
Right. Well, let me ask you on a to take one special feature of all of this, which you were involved in and bringing out at the time, is that you take a place like Haiti, which you said in the past, it has a glorious past at the time of the as being a friend of the new American Republic and so forth. But let's take the recent past. In 2010 was the earthquake there. And the knowing that already this process was going on of undermining the ability, there were maybe 10 million, the population might be 10 million people, and this dumping of rice, free trade, was impoverishing them on deliberately. But then came the earthquake. So the question was called, we should change a policy here. And people went to the White House and said, we should change the policy in the sense that let's move the stricken people to higher ground and let's intervene with infrastructure. So you have sanitation in Port-au-Prince and you have the electricity, you have the means to protect these people. The only reason I'm throwing this in here is, well, it's about President Obama's reaction, but in the 1950s, I think it was under President Eisenhower, there had been a watershed development with an electric dam and the means to irrigate and so forth. But this particular case of Haiti after 2010 is grounds for impeachment for Obama, Lyndon LaRouche, and we said at the time. Would you address that?
Yes. Well, Haiti is just an absolute deliberate case of genocide, because what LaRouche proposed at the time, and you were involved in putting together the program that we published in terms of immediate emergency Army Corps of Engineer involvement, almost military mobilization that would have been required to build housing, etc. That wasn't done. We had the subsequent outbreak of cholera.
Yeah, within, I think, 6-8 months.
In October of 2010, the earthquake was in January. Mm-hmm. The official figure of deaths from cholera is something like 8,000 people, but absolutely the danger is not eradicated in any way. You have today, the World Food Program just put out the figure that 2 out of 3 Haitians are starving. There is no food. And keep in mind, billions of dollars were pledged supposedly to rebuild Haiti. They called it Building Back Better. The basis of that reconstruction program is what? Building luxury hotels, that's your job creation. Building slave labor, textile assembly plants.
Oh yeah, the garment, cheap labor to undercut Bangladesh. And
yeah, cheaper, you know, some of these predators, they pulled out of Nicaragua and Honduras because it was too expensive and they moved to Haiti. Unfortunately, Bill and Hillary Clinton have pushed this thing to the hilt. Huge new, quote, industry built on the northern coast. This is supposed to provide jobs and infrastructure for, you know, probably not
to service the cruise ships. I think they have, they do have, yes, set aside ports for the
absolutely
cruise ship.
Maybe, I don't even think the wage is $1 a day, or it's something like 90 cents a day. And I mean, this is just slave labor. And there is no, we put out also our own proposal for how you could increase food production. Nuclear energy, why not? And any number of projects that could very quickly provide jobs, education, you know, universities were wiped out with the earthquake. So this is just an absolute catastrophe. And if you think back, not only was Haiti crucial in terms of Alexander Hamilton had input into the writing of the Haitian Constitution. And there was actually a very important collaborative relationship. The Haitian Revolution of 1804 was the second revolution in the hemisphere, and of course by a black population and nation, which the British and French weren't too happy about. But Franklin Roosevelt had a very interesting relationship with Haiti, and through the Good Neighbor Policy promoted mechanisms that allowed Haiti to produce food. So that's something that is really significant to keep in mind when we're looking at the current situation.
Yeah, I'll just throw in one of the, you mentioned the garment, this was supposed to, this is called Rebuilding Better. It's British East India Company, if there ever was anything like that. And the one particular agriculture thing is the Obama food USAID specialized in giving contracts for partnerships, such as to Coca-Cola, to build a facility in Haiti and several where local mangoes could be grown, the pulp concentrated and the mango pulp being shipped to the United States so you can buy your health food drinks of mango pineapple juice from Haiti. This was motivated. This is actually the leading edge of the USAID Bill Gates policy for Africa and everything else. Private partnerships with Coca-Cola and others in Ethiopia here and there. It's a genocidal food policy. There's no, it's a pretense, we can mock it, but this is underway and this is what we are committed to stopping. Absolutely. That's what, again, we refer back to the sovereign, we have to restore sovereignty here in the United States, which would be sovereignty over our credit and banking system so it serves the nation in the future. Now, with that in mind, do you want to at this point describe some of the just the general outline of what the North American Water and Power Alliance sister projects or what's involved in moving water from where it is in southern Mexico northward?
Right. Well, there are two basic projects that really would, were they to be built, and I should say these are projects like NOAPA have been on the shelf for a number of years. I mean, these are not,
I think they're from the 1960s, yeah, probably
about the same time as NOAPA. You have the PLINO, which is the Northwest Hydraulic Plan, and then you have the Northern Gulf Hydraulic Plan, which is the acronym is the PLIGON. We've written about this extensively. These are projects which actually, it's not one single project, but the idea is to bring water from southern Mexico, which has a surplus of water, transport it along the coast and actually through some fairly difficult geography of the eastern Sierra Madre and the Gulf Coast and the western on the Pacific Coast, and through a series of building dams, pumping stations, many nuclear plants, to transport the water from the south to the north. And at the same time, in the case of the PLIGON, you could also bring an estimated, I think, 1.5 million hectares into agricultural production in southeastern Mexico, in Tabasco, the states of Tabasco and Campeche, to create a whole new agricultural area there. Because right now, these are areas that are flooded very frequently. This was something that, we've proposed this. We have some American engineer, Hal Cooper. We have the very well-respected Mexican engineer, Frias, who have elaborated these projects in great detail. If they were to be put in place at the same time as NOAPA from the north, and NOAPA would hook into the eastern branch of NOAPA would hook into the PLIGON, you would transform those parched lands of northern Mexico into absolutely fertile, you know, bountiful producers of food, vast quantities of food. And the PLINO, for example, there's actually been a fight around the PLINO for a number of years. The LaRouche movement in Mexico and many of its friends, especially in the northern state of Sonora, where this is a real issue, have made this absolutely an issue in people's minds. Right now in Sonora, one of the most important agricultural states in the country, the current governor, who's really just an asset of the WWF and backed by the financiers connected to the WWF, has this crazy proposal to take water from the Yaqui River, which is in southern Sonora, and build an aqueduct, take the water from the Yaqui River, I guess, until it runs dry, and bring it into the city of Hermosillo, which, you know, makes absolutely no sense.
Can I just point out a counterpart? It's the same kind of thing. There's an effort to do to similarly feed supply Las Vegas with water that way, because the Colorado Basin, in which it's located near Lake Mead, is completely overallocated for supplying towns, agriculture, and every but that all you're doing is drying up any other activity in order for Las Vegas or Hermosillo or and the same situation obtains in California. Go ahead.
So there's an alliance of people from the LaRouche movement, but also from the Yaqui Indian grouping against this proposal. And recently, in fact, the Supreme Court upheld a lower court decision to stop the project until all aspects of it could be considered and really analyzed, etc. So the movement that we're involved in has been organizing very, very aggressively against this, but also demanding that the president of Mexico get involved and see this as a question of sovereignty and, you know, general welfare for the population, not just of Sonora, but all of Mexico. So, and, you know, Lyndon LaRouche, during his visits to Mexico in the past decade, 2002, I mean, he made this an issue, not just the Pleno, but looking at it from the broader standpoint of what has to be done to not only defend the Mexican nation, but also bring Mexico and the United States together in the kind of alliance that will be of mutual benefit to both from the standpoint of sovereignty.
Right. And this gets, just to throw in here again, a couple of senators, I'm not going to try and remember who, recently introduced a similar, we want the water in the Rio Grande River Valley, the Rio Bravo, which of course the water isn't there. It's not there. It rises the Pecos system in the up headwaters area, the Rio Grande and the head. So you can't, so the there's a bill in the Senate to say Mexico's withholding water from their side. Well, of course, it's impossible because the water isn't there.
Right.
The same thing with the Colorado. But again, I'm sure from what you've been reporting in EIR, and by the way, that was the June 14 EIR online that Cynthia referred to. It's the latest EIR online. Look for the material of hers on Mexico, on what could be done, this project, what must be done. And but it's, I understand, but it's this is just extreme. Trucks can't even truck in enough water, I think, in certain areas. And I noticed you reported the governor of Durango, which is a state to the south of Sonora, and where years ago a lot of blue jean factories relocated, so, you know, but he is saying we cannot survive.
Right. There was actually on May 29th, a meeting of the National Governors, the Water Commission of the National Governors Association met with the Water Commission of the lower house to discuss this catastrophe. And it really was an emergency session because everyone has agreed that this is just unbelievably, just unacceptable that Mexicans are dying. And one of the things that this Governor Herrera said, who's the head of the Water Commission for the governors, is now we have to talk about water projects, and even if they're expensive, we have to pay for them, because the consequences of not doing that are just not acceptable. And this particular governor, interestingly enough, a year ago, right after Peña Nieto was elected, when he was president-elect, he made a public statement, kind of threw down the gauntlet to him and said, we've got to bring water from southern Mexico. He didn't mention the Pligon, but in fact, that's what he was talking about.
There are only certain river valleys.
Yes. We've got to build aqueducts, he said. We've got to transport the water to northern Mexico or we're not going to survive. And he said, this is the challenge that the Mexican Congress has to take up now. This is the challenge that the president, the new president, has to take up. Of course, Peña Nieto came in December. That was last July. So these projects aren't unknown. The problem here, and that the Mexican, the LaRouche movement, the Mosila in Mexico, made the point because they were at this particular meeting. People are calling for new credit agencies to be set up. They're calling for, dramatic, immediate aid to the drought-stricken areas. They're calling for infrastructure projects. Fine. But if we look at the magnitude of the global crisis, the global breakdown of the economy, the threat of thermonuclear war with our insane president, the British drive for depopulation through genocide. What they're calling for is not going to happen inside Mexico, and their fight inside Mexico isn't going to win it, right? Which is why we're saying you've got to find your international allies. LaRouche in the United States is your international ally, to fight with him, as Lopez Portillo did, on the basis of a shared outlook for sovereignty, for mutual respect and interest, mutual interest of having that kind of relationship. That is what the Mexican nationalists now have to do. There's no internal battle that's going to change things. And that means also Glass-Steagall for Mexico. The Mexican financiers and speculators are still there working with their international allies like George Soros and others.
Carlos Slim,
the multi-billionaire, to destroy Mexico. So therefore, there's no winning this thing as the local battle. And I think it would be interesting to mention the case I mentioned Roosevelt earlier, and his discussion, his relationship with Mexico. But there's this really wonderful example of in 1940, because of course Mexico, Roosevelt had a relationship with Mexico, and there were many, many opportunities and many enemies of Mexico within the United States who sought to blow up the U.S.-Mexican relationship. Mm-hmm. Especially after Mexico nationalized its oil industry in 1938. But Roosevelt handled it in a very, very astute way, always thinking of what do our nations have in common and how can we work on that. In 1940, right after Roosevelt was elected, Henry Wallace was his vice president, the vice president.
Yeah, he'd been a couple terms as agriculture secretary, right.
Henry Wallace took a trip to Mexico. He actually drove to Mexico from Washington. And
I think he might have come from Washington. I read some of his work that he wasn't inaugurated yet, and he had time on his hands. He might have gone from Iowa, his home state, but he went as Plymouth. That I remember.
Right. But he went to Mexico, being an agronomist, wasn't?
Yes. Yeah, he was a specialist in corn. Of course, he was thrilled because Mexico is the home of the origin of corn.
Right. But he went to Mexico, and I believe he was there for about a month, and he traveled all around. Because he wanted to investigate what was happening with yields, corn yields, and different breeds of corn, wheat also. And he was welcomed so warmly by the Mexican farmers, because he visited every different kind of farm, subsistence farms, industrial, you know,
Big
larger,
ones.
right, experimental stations. And he was very concerned as how Mexico might increase its yield of both corn and wheat. And he was instrumental in going through the Rockefeller Institute, I believe it was called.
Foundation, I don't
Foundation,
know.
Okay.
The problem is that all the money was, resources were so tied up in the war effort, he had to seek some other source of funding.
Right. So he ended up helping to create an experimental station outside of Mexico City, which began operating in 1943, brought in Dr. Norman Borlaug, who we associate with the successful Green Revolution. And Borlaug worked on increasing yields for corn, looking at how you might create rust-resistant wheat. But from 20 years after that station began operation, Mexico went from becoming a wheat importer to an exporter. Corn production doubled, wheat production fivefold increase. So this is not to be confused with the Queen's green fascism. But this was the kind of cooperation that the Mexicans were so became so endeared to Wallace because of his approach of how can we work together to figure this problem out and help you increase your corn production and your wheat production. So and I just wanted to mention, read from a letter that when Roosevelt was elected in 1940, he received a letter from then President Cárdenas, who was just about to leave office, congratulating him. And Cárdenas mentions in his letter, he said, by being reelected, Mr. President, you give us hope that the policies of reciprocal respect may be consolidated as a lasting kind of relationship between countries whose proximity requires cordiality. You know, it talks about the motives of justice, which Roosevelt was committed to, and expresses the hope that his government will continue in this direction of seeking justice for all of the American nations. And Roosevelt responded, saying that I'm happy that it seems the people of the United States approve of my policy of inter-American solidarity and cooperation, and which is so essential to improve the welfare of the people and the nations of America. Said, I know that these policies can only be successful when they're based on a sincere respect for the rights inherent in national independence and sovereignty. So that's, I thought, was really nice.
Right. And there might be other examples during the war in other parts of South America, but even at other times, I think I mentioned about Haiti, that the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers did a project under Eisenhower, I think.
Right.
Go ahead.
I believe that was the Peligra Dam.
Yes.
Right, which is located in the Artibonite.
Yes.
On the Artibonite River.
Correct. The largest river, longest. It's a Haiti's obviously half an island nation,
right?
And small.
Hispaniola. Right. And the Artibonite Valley is actually Haiti's breadbasket because it's the most fertile land. And interestingly, Wallace's, the institute that Wallace set up, which is based in San Jose, Costa Rica, was involved, this was some years later in the 50s, in devising a development program for the Artibonite Valley. From the standpoint of how you could increase food production, and not only that, but also create technical institutes and educational facilities to train agronomists and really sort of raise the educational level of the population. So that's really nice. One other thing I just wanted to mention quickly is one other project, and this really is taking the thing to the level of the global land bridge development that we've talked about. A couple of years ago, 2 3 years ago, we put out the project for the what's called the Darien Gap, which is this 60-mile piece of rainforest or marshland between Colombia and
the
Panama.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the isthmus, which is kind of a no man's land because it's said to be completely uninhabitable, except the narco-terrorists of the FARC, the Colombian FARC, have made it their little territory. They operate there. This is an area also which the WWF has proclaimed to be a biosphere reserve.
Untouchable by humans?
Yes. Therefore, there can be no development. But we put forward a program on how to bridge the Darien Gap through railroad construction. Hal Cooper also had some interesting proposals for this. Bridging the Darien Gap, but seeing it also as a key piece of what would be a hemispheric plan for infrastructure development, railroads, the Pan-American Railroad, which McKinley, our President McKinley, had proposed and was a key aspect of his whole continental development perspective. The railroad only goes to the Darien Gap, never got further than that. Pan-American Highway goes to the Darien Gap and then continues, stops, and then continues further down. But the point is, if you built the tunnel under the Bering Strait, you could have a connection, a literal link to all of North America, also into Europe, but North America, Central America, then have that connect into key infrastructure projects, the corridors, the North-South corridors in South America that include the Venezuelan Colombian plains that are very fertile, like the Great Plains of the United States.
Yeah, this is one part. It was a great cattle region too.
Yes,
right? Is that the idea?
The Brazilian Cerrado area. You could vastly increase food production in the heartland of South America, which would obviously have a huge impact. You've got obviously the huge agricultural producers of Argentina, grains. Unfortunately, today they're also producing gigantic amounts of soybeans, which have replaced wheat as their main export item.
Yeah, this is part of these conglomerates,
right.
And also part of the, it's another aspect of, ADM, Cargill, and so forth, Monsanto, who breeds the seeds for this, claims patent rights to, China needs food because it just like they're exporting electronics and toys and shoes, which has been a whole accommodation to this world monetarist regime, which is no good for nobody. No, they've been forced into a decision where they'd like to be food self-sufficient, but they require something like 58 million tons a year of soybeans from the U.S. and from Brazil,
right,
and from Argentina.
Right.
And so they're exporting apple juice and fish and everything else to make some money for the, so we have a mess on our hands,
yeah.
But the area is rich.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. So this perspective that I just outlined is a crucial aspect of that, and obviously connects into the whole NOAPA perspective as well.
Right. Well, I think that takes us back around to where we started from, that there's no reason for the scale of this is horrifying, that we've reached the end of the line in terms of taking of human life, which is the goal behind these financial work, financial networks and operations that have brought us to this point. And so it's going to be one way or another, and we know what we're committed to. So I ask everyone, again, I'm repeating, do everything you can. Congress is resuming in Washington, but every flank is every thinking person who's in that. It may be a minority, but it can be all it takes all around the country of people in office or otherwise leaders who will, just because they'll step forward, that we have to have this Glass-Steagall reinstituted and all of the policies we just described going with it, if we're going to have water and power and food and a future. And again, the conference on the 29th of June in San Francisco, there's a great likelihood we'll have Mexican representation, a delegation, at least of one or more. From Australia will come representatives, but from the Western states especially, do go there. I'm having to close out. I'm very glad we had Cynthia Rush, June 15, 2013, for the LaRouche Show. Thank you very much.